Erno! Erno Rubik, get in here!
What is it, Ma?
This report card, Erno! How can you be dumb as a hamster when your brother and your sister are so smart?
I'm smart, Ma.
Look at your brother. Marty Rubik is one of the top CPAs in Hungary. He'd take you in if you finished accounting school.
Ma, Marty's not the sharpest knife in the drawer. The last book he read had pictures of bears dressed up as people.
Again, with the books, why can't you be like your sister Evelyn? She didn't need books to start Evelyn Rubik's House of Goulash. She's got 3 locations in Budapest already, and next week she opens...
Ma, Evelyn is a moron. She thought Taco Bell was a phone company.
Well, she was smart enough to know you could make money in the restaurant business in a country called Hungary.
See, even that's kind of stupid. Ma, if you could just look at the cube.
Not the cube again. Erno, people don't like the cube. It's broken. People don't like broken.
It's not broken. It's scrambled up. But people can solve it using mathematical group theory. They'll be using algorithms without knowing it.
Why would they do that when they can buy a thing that's already nice and won't give them a headache? Here, take some of your sister's goulash down to your brother's office while I introduce this show about intelligence. And now, he took an IQ test, but he got lost in the maze, and the rats wouldn't help him. Colin McEnroe.
We're going to be talking about intelligence today. Oh, the poor Rubiks, or at least poor Erno Rubik, misunderstood in his own family. But it does sort of point to the fact that we think about intelligence in ways that are often kind of convenient to us, as opposed to perhaps testable or universal. So we're going to talk about that today. This is a word or a series of words, intelligent, smart. These are words that we throw around all the time, and we throw them around as if we know what they meant. But do we really know what they mean? So joining us for the first few segments today will be Richard Nisbet. He is a professor of social psychology and co-director of the Culture and Cognition Program at the University of Michigan at Ann Arbor. He's the author of Mindware, Tools for Smart Thinking. Annie Murphy Paul is a writer, consultant, and speaker on the topic of learning. She's the author of The Brilliant Blog and the forthcoming book Thinking Outside the Brain, The Power of Our Surroundings to Make Us Better. So Annie Murphy Paul, I am going to begin with you. What is intelligence? Is there a way to sum this up? Does this word actually have a meaning that we've all settled on, that we can all agree upon?
Well, there's many different definitions of intelligence out there. The one that I end up using is comes from a group that call themselves Mainstream Science for Mainstream Science on Intelligence. And this was a letter signed by a bunch of leading scientists back in 1994, when, if you remember, the whole bell curve controversy over intelligence and race was underway. And mm-hmm. They wrote a letter that was published in the Wall Street Journal, and I'll just read you quickly their definition because I find it very useful. Intelligence is a very general mental capacity that, among other things, involves the ability to reason, plan, solve problems, think abstractly, comprehend complex ideas, learn quickly, and learn from experience. It's not merely book learning, a narrow academic skill, or test-taking smarts. Rather, it reflects a broader and deeper capability for understanding our surroundings, catching on, making sense of things, or figuring out what to do. Now, that's a lot of words, obviously, to define one single term, but the history of intelligence and the study of intelligence has been so fraught and so controversial that I think it's useful to have a really thoughtful, nuanced definition like that. But I'm sure Professor Nesbitt has his own definition. He's really the expert on this, so maybe we should ask him.
Well, before we ask Richard Nesbitt that, let me just sort of say that definition sounds like the definition of a lot of different things, which probably conforms to people's experience. In other words, I know that Paul McCartney's brain has a facility, an understanding, an intelligence about music, and that facility does exist in his brain. It exists at the level of thought. He can think about things that I could never think about, that I could barely understand if he tried to explain them to me. I also feel like I could beat him at Jeopardy really easily. In a lot of other ways, I'm guessing I'm probably, quote-unquote, smarter than he is. I mean, a definition as broad as the one that you read strikes me as useful in the sense that it seems to include a lot of different things that do strike us as intelligence, but not useful in the sense that it really doesn't narrow the thing down very much.
Mm-hmm. Well, you might get a more specific, hold on this idea if maybe we described intelligence as the ability to solve the problems that matter to you. So you can solve the problems, involving your radio show, but not the problems of writing a song like the ones the Beatles wrote.
Right. So Richard Nisbet, let's go to Richard Nisbet now. So that seems both true and a little, once again, a little bit self-serving or a little bit not entirely as useful as we'd like it to be. In other words, if intelligence is simply the ability to solve the problems that one has picked out to solve or that life has picked out for us to solve, and they're not all the same problems, are we even talking about a phenomenon that we can look at across a whole bunch of different disciplines?
Well, you can certainly look at it across a bunch of disciplines. I actually endorse that definition which was just given. In fact, when I write about it, that's the definition I give. I don't think it's I don't think it's too general to match the fact that our concepts of intelligence are very, very general. I mean, there are many kinds of things we would call intelligence, and most of them are pretty well captured by that definition. But what I'm mostly concerned about with testing IQ is that it narrows down on a relatively small set of cognitive operations. They're very important, all of them, but they're not everything. So I argue that there's such a thing as being able to score high on an IQ test and still lacking a huge range of skills that would be very useful in the modern world. And we all lack those, but I've spent a lot of my career looking at sort of tricks of the trade, cognitive skills that make us smarter, but wouldn't actually be captured on an IQ test.
So, Annie said that the definition that she read arose, I think I'm saying this right, kind of after the climate of conversation and controversy at times that was occasioned by books like The Bell Curve. That was Charles Murray's book, and that was preceded by a bunch of work by actually a couple of scientists in particular who had no real background in intelligence. William Shockley, a physicist who'd won the Nobel Prize and is actually responsible for some of the semiconductors that we use in computers, and there was a guy named Jensen, too, I think, who also had a similar not a background in this kind of thing. And they were all making these similar arguments, which is that that minorities, especially African-Americans, don't test as well on the IQ test. And they expanded that into a social argument and saying that that was sort of an inflexible problem. That was a problem that wasn't going to change. And I assume, Richard Nisbet, that that's one of the reasons that we started thinking about a much broader way of understanding intelligence, that this test, I'll ask a question instead of that. I mean, what the question I immediately had even back then was, well, if this test is made by a sort of white male-dominated group of people who make tests, and it's pretty good at measuring how well you're going to do out in the world or how much money you're going to make in a white male-dominated society, maybe it's not testing intelligence so much as testing how well you conform to a certain set of standards.
Well, actually, I think IQ tests do test terribly important skills, and I'm perfectly willing to use IQ tests as a measure within our culture of our larger culture of skills, which are very important to have. The racial thing, they got wrong, and just as an aside, I'll say it could have been known at the time to be wrong. We actually have a huge amount of evidence, did at the time, on African-Americans versus European-Americans. And all of that evidence, and now I'm talking about scores and scores of studies of at least 20 or 30 different designs, which show that the difference in IQ between blacks and whites owes nothing to genes. Genes are very important for intelligence, that's for sure. It's just that they don't differ across those two particular groups. The best example I can give of that, the most telling study, but they all fit this to one degree or another, with one exception. You have black kids, who are some of whom are pure African ancestry, and both parents are black, and some of whom one parent is black and one parent is white. All the kids in this study now are going to be adopted, and they're adopted either by black middle-class families or white middle-class families. And now you look at what their IQ is after they've been raised in those environments. And what you find is that for the black kids, whether they are mixed race or pure African in origin, their IQs are the same, whether they're raised in black families or in white families. But the difference between kids raised in black families and the kid raised in white families is essentially the entire difference in IQ, which existed at the time of the study, which is about 14 or 15 points. So it's just a very clear way of showing that it's a subcultural difference which is producing that difference between African Americans on the whole and European Americans on the whole. And by the way, I'm happy to say now that 22 years after that book was written, half of the IQ difference between blacks and whites, which existed at that time, is now gone. So much for the prediction that nothing could be done about the IQ difference between the races.
Exactly. So, Annie, I'm going to play a clip for you of a man whose voice you will immediately recognize, although perhaps not entirely happily.
I went to the Wharton School of Finance. I was an excellent student. I'm a smart person.
Who are you consulting with consistently so that you're ready on day one?
I'm speaking with myself, number one, because I have a very good brain and I've said a lot of things.
I told you, I went to the Wharton School of Finance. I was like, I'm like a really smart person. My uncle was a perfect doctor. John Trump was at MIT, one of the smartest people. Like, you know, smart, right?
So, Annie, I'm not asking you to tell us whether or not Donald Trump is as smart as he thinks he is, or even whether he's smart. But he's making a set of claims which are very pertinent to people right now. They are going to essentially make a choice between probably two people to run the country, and they don't want to pick somebody who's not very smart. So we're sort of back to your question, to your issue. In other words, does smart mean able to solve the tasks that might come up in front of you, or does smart mean something else, particularly when we need somebody to be quote-unquote intelligent?
Mm-hmm. Well, going back to that definition that I proposed, a working definition that would say smart is as smart does. In other words, intelligence is the ability to solve the problems that matter to you in your life. A really important aspect of being smart, of knowing how to solve problems, is to know what you don't know. And I would suggest that is where Donald Trump falls down on the definition of being a truly intelligent individual, because we all, as humans, we all fool ourselves. We all are ignorant and we don't know that we're ignorant, but we can cultivate an awareness of a humility about what we know and what we don't know. And it's very dangerous, frankly, to not be aware that one's knowledge isn't complete, it isn't all-encompassing. And so the truly intelligent person has to always have that awareness that their knowledge is limited and that humans are by nature kind of self-deluding, you know, we fool ourselves a lot. We don't know the extent of our own ignorance.
Well, let's also set Mr. Trump aside for just a second. And I mean, the other question that I would have, Annie, is it seems as though the skill sets that translate into competence, intelligence, smartness, whatever we want to call it out in the world, shift a lot. In other words, we go through revolutions. We went through an industrial revolution, where we've been through an information revolution. So I would also assume that the things that portend excellence are not necessarily fixed constants. In other words, certain thinking styles are probably a little bit more useful right now than they were 50 years ago.
Mm-hmm. That's absolutely right. I mean, what the skills and capabilities that are valued in the workplace or even in schools today are different from those of 50 years and different from those of 100 years ago. But I think that's why that sort of long, wordy definition that I read out at the beginning of this hour is useful, because it is so general. It doesn't specify particular skills or ways of thinking so much as saying it's the ability to catch on, to figure out what's going on. And that is very, as you point out, is very dependent on the time and place.
And so, Richard Nisbett, do the conventional instruments of measuring IQ measure that? In other words, you said before that you ultimately do endorse and believe in our capacity to measure something that we call IQ. Does it measure the thing that she's talking about right now?
Namely, our ability to think about the things we care about? Is that what?
Yeah, or the things that we need to think about, I guess, in order to solve a problem that's in front of us.
Yeah, well, I wouldn't want to restrict it in that way at all. I mean, back to the issue of Donald Trump's intelligence.
Okay.
There's a lovely finding by a colleague of mine named David Dunning and his colleague, whose name is Kruger, called the Dunning-Kruger effect. And it shows that the more intelligent a person is, the better calibrated they are with respect to how much they know. If you're sufficiently unintelligent, you're hopelessly badly calibrated. You have no idea of how ignorant you are. Mm-hmm. The smarter you are, the more aware you are of areas where you are actually ignorant. What's stunning to me about Donald Trump, I take it for granted that in the ordinary sense, he's smart. I mean, he certainly made a lot of money. He certainly managed to make himself a celebrity, and partly it's not just by antics, it's by being clever. And he's managed, after all, to win the nomination of a major political party. Given that, I find his areas of ignorance just staggering. And nothing could be more unsettling than this idea that we just, from the quotes you just read, of how would I handle foreign policy? What do you know? No, no problem. I have a big brain. Well, a big brain, I mean, you can have an enormous brain in a vat. I mean, that it doesn't make any difference. The question is, what do you know about it? What have you been? I mean, imagine that you or I were suddenly put into Trump's shoes as an executive of a major company that builds buildings. And now you have to act in that function. You have to direct it. I mean, it was completely terrifying to me. I don't know a tiny fraction of what would be necessary to be an effective person in that kind of role. And it's very much that way for anything to do with policy or with strategy and dealing with foreign countries and so on. The ignorance there takes the breath away, honestly. And it does because he's a I think he's a stupid man. I don't think he's a stupid man, but it just the intellectual tools that are necessary to think effectively about the kinds of problems that would confront a president are astonishing. And I think I don't know whether he really understands that he could no more step into the presidency with his level of knowledge than you or I could step into the role of executive of an architectural firm.
There's a lot of places I might want to go from there, but Annie, just in the interest of time, let's go to one of Richard's models there. You know, what would happen if he or you or I were suddenly thrust into the role of real estate tycoon or something like that? One of the things that we would do immediately, I think, is say to ourselves, I don't really know that much about this situation I'm in, but I know how to get information. And there's never been a time in the history of the world where more information was accessible. So, and in some ways, my broader question to you is, I feel as though, not to keep using Jeopardy as an example, but that, you know, that Ken Jennings could be beaten at Jeopardy by a reasonably smart millennial with a smartphone who was kind of allowed 60 seconds to use it. That increasingly the mind that sits inside the casing of our skull is only the beginning of what our intelligence is.
That's exactly right. And that's my problem with conventional IQ tests. If you think about how it's such a test is given, you're put in a room by yourself. You can't draw on the intelligence of other people. You can't use your tools, your computer or your calculator. You're taken out of your usual physical space, which may help you think in various ways. You're taken out of your cultural and organizational setting. All these things help us think. And there's something very interesting happening in fields as diverse as psychology and neuroscience and cognitive science and philosophy, even suggesting that our idea that intelligence is something located exclusively inside the brain, we're coming to see that that's very limited. And especially in these days when the problems that confront us are so complicated and so complex, one isolated person working alone, without tools, without the ability to use their body, which is, of course, restricted when you're taking an IQ test as well, that's not going to work to solve our problems. And so this thing that we've been calling intelligence is really just one small part of what intelligence really is in the real world.
See, you're kind of making the argument that McLuhan made, right? McLuhan said that technology would allow us to extend our dendrites out into the universe, that ultimately our neurophysiology would, and I guess Teilhard de Chardin almost said a kind of similar thing, that it would build out somehow, that it would get connected to other things, that our minds would essentially be extended by technology.
Yes, and that's what the World Wide Web is, really. I mean, McLuhan was really prescient, I think, in seeing what would happen with technology. But I think we also have to include relationships with other people. I mean, that's a way that humans have been making themselves more intelligent than they could be on their own for millennia before computers or anything was ever invented. And also what we can do with our institutions and our intellectual traditions. These things really can extend our intelligence far beyond what the individual brain can do.
So, Richard Nisbet, what about that? I mean, it does seem as though, certainly in the age of Erasmus or John Stuart Mill or Thomas Jefferson, it was certainly useful and desirable to have people who were really, really smart and really, really knew a lot of things and were these kind of self-contained apparati of intelligence and brilliance. But what about the argument that measuring that now kind of ignores the reality that so many things are collaborative and so much of our brain is plugged into a big set of computers that we should just really be really good at using?
Well, I do think that's true. I think to be effectively intelligent requires a lot of collaboration with human beings and with machines today. I mean, you can certainly be perfectly intelligent and not be connected in those ways. But for most of the things, certainly that I want to do professionally, I mean, I'm constantly aware of how dependent I am. I pick up the phone. Who uses a phone? I email the expert on something. I'm doing that constantly. I'm checking Wikipedia many times a day, and of course, I'm using my colleagues who are better data analysts than I am are using external machines all the time to derive summaries of what's true in the world and how you might change those things. So that's certainly true.
So I'm going to ask one last question before we go to break here, but I think this comes from a tweet, too. Stephanie is tweeting at us. IQ scores perpetuate our competitive culture and harm actual people. Motivation is the strongest driver of learning. I'll phrase it a different way, and I want to hear from both of you, but I'll start with you, Annie. So I'll quickly tell you a story, which is that when I was going into seventh grade, my mother accidentally saw a list of the IQ scores. I was going to a boys' school of all the boys in my class, and she didn't tell me what was on it or anything like that. She just kind of tortured me with it for the next 6 years. And apparently I had a pretty high IQ score. And if I didn't do as well as another boy, she'd go, well, he's not as smart as you are. you should be doing better. And what bothers me a lot was that one of the boys was this guy named Bob Greenberg, who actually was one of the original founders, along with Bill Gates, of Microsoft, basically. He was one of the guys in the garage with Bill Gates. And I was constantly being judged and told, well, I should be getting better grades in math than Bob Greenberg because my IQ score said I was smarter than Bob Greenberg. I'm here to tell you, I was not smarter than Bob Greenberg. He was a lot smarter than me. So, I mean, things like that and the tweet that we got, there's sort of an argument for saying, well, why quantify this anyway? What's the social good that comes out of quantifying something like this?
Yes, I think, one thing that IQ scores and a focus on IQ scores leads to is what the Stanford psychologist Carol Dweck calls a fixed mindset. Your mother was kind of engaging in that when she said, well, you're X smart and that other person is Y smart, so you should be getting better grades. And, the idea that our abilities are set by something like an IQ score or indicated in some final and definite way by an IQ score is a really dangerous idea, I think. And it does promote, as Stephanie tweeted, this idea of a competition when, just to go back to a variant of the IQ, of the intelligence, the definition of intelligence that we've been kind of circling around, this idea that the kind of intelligence that really matters is the kind that allows you to do what you want to do, what your personal projects are. And I just want to put in a plug for a wonderful book that uses that definition of intelligence. It's called Ungifted by Scott Barry Kaufman. And he proposes a new definition of intelligence as the capability that allows you to solve problems and make progress in the areas of life that you care about. And to me, that makes a whole lot of sense.
So, Richard Nisbett, obviously your research is facilitated by the existence of IQ scores. If nobody ever quantified any of this stuff about anybody, you'd have to go at your work in a very different way. But beyond that, beyond the ability to do research, out there in the real world, is there any real value would the world be a better place if nobody knew anybody's IQ scores?
I think there would be something to be said for that, but let's not kid ourselves. I mean, we don't give IQ scores tests much anymore. It just isn't very common. It's very useful to me as a scientist. I mean, you can track how the society is doing. And by the way, we have gotten astonishingly higher IQs over the last 100 years. I mean, it's essentially a person with an IQ of 100 in 1947 would. Because that's the average of IQ, and we always define the average as being 100, just arbitrarily. That person today would get an IQ score of less than 85. So that's the difference between being able to function in every way, in a normal way, and someone who would be very slow and find it very difficult to do anything other than relatively menial tasks. Or at the other end, if you had an IQ of 115 at that time, that would only be an average IQ. We don't know exactly why IQs have been increasing. They've been increasing throughout the Western world now, for the rich world, for 100 years at least. And it's begun in developing countries that are fairly far along, places like Brazil and Iran and so on. And it's starting now in the very most impoverished countries. It seems to be topping out in Scandinavian countries, so that may be as far as we're going to go with the kinds of skills that get tested by IQ tests. But what I'm much more concerned with than IQ-type things are the kinds of routines, procedures that we can use to understand the everyday world that aren't touched by IQ tests at all. The IQ tests were designed to measure the skills that were essential for the industrial age, but we're in a different age now. We're in the information age. And there's a whole set of skills that are necessary to function sensibly with data. and they come from statistics and probability, scientific methodology, some philosophy of science concepts, cost-benefit decision rules, and so on. Now, people have heard of, for example, take the law of large numbers, which everyone's heard of in some version. I mean, more data is better than less data, and that's especially true if the data is noisy. People use that. Many people use that on a daily basis in their professions, but it can be used every day in our personal lives as well. And it's not. The tools have been around for 150 years now for the information age. Most of them, many of them, but very few of them. Have trickled down to where we can use them in everyday life.
All right, Richard Nisbet, we're going to have to grab a break right now. Nate Silver is telling us we have to go to a break. And, you know, obviously he's kind of in control now for exactly the reasons you're talking about. And we're talking about the idea of intelligence with Richard Nisbet. He is professor of social psychology and co-director of the Culture and Cognition Program at the University of Michigan at Ann Arbor. He is the author of Mindware, Tools for Smart Thinking. Annie Murphy-Paul is also with us, writer, consultant, and speaker on the topic of learning. She's the author of The Brilliant Blog and the forthcoming book, Thinking Outside the Brain, The Power of Our Surroundings to Make Us Smarter. So, Annie Murphy-Paul, I was about to say something that I now realize is wrong. I was about to say that we live in an age where there's an unprecedented amount of stuff being shoved at us with the suggestion that it can make us smarter or make our children smarter or make our unborn children smarter or make our sperm smarter or whatever. Sperm and eggs, obviously. But, but really, in fact, this has been going on forever, and there have been various versions of this that have existed, you know, certainly for all of my life and longer still. That notion of self-improvement, that notion that you can make your brain, your mind better by doing this or that. There were gurus about this, like Mortimer Adler or, you know, people like that in the 50s and 60s. So, but right now there's this notion anyway, there's stuff you can do either to make your child smarter or to stave off incipient mental decline as you, the baby boomer, enter your 60s and 70s. How much of it actually has any utility?
Well, you're right that there's a whole industry ranging from educational toys for babies and children to, you know, Lumosity and the brain training programs that seem to be advertised everywhere on the web these days. And, to speak first to the children, to this young people aspect of how to make them smarter, that really what we know about helping kids become smarter doesn't suggest that using educational toys and products is the way to go, but rather just to engage them in back and forth conversation with adults who care about them. And that and reading are the two kind of low tech ways that actually really do make children smarter. And then as for the brain training programs, there's not a whole lot of evidence that that works in the sense that you will get better at the brain training games themselves, but those improved skills don't transfer to your daily life, which presumably is why you would want to sharpen your skills in the first place. So what I tell people is you shouldn't so much be exercising your brain with these tools and programs. You should be exercising your body. That's physical fitness and physical aerobic exercise is there's a quite a large research base to suggest that that is the best way to stave off mental decline and to keep your mental faculties sharp.
Richard Nisbet, in some ways, I think we're a society that looks for shortcuts. If I buy this particular program, if I take ginkgo biloba or some kind of other supplement, if I do this or I do that, I can boost my brain or I can boost my child's brain. I'm guessing that a researcher like you is thinking, no, pretty much the normal course of what we call education is what's going to make you smarter.
That's right. These computer programs that are supposed to make you smarter, there's very little evidence that they do much that has lasting, substantial effect. And in any case, those kinds of things are geared for what's called fluid intelligence. That's the ability to think in abstractions, especially the ability to hold things in mind at the same time as you solve problems. You maybe can get some of these exercises maybe can make you a little bit better at those things, but that's not the core of intelligence. I mean, everybody has enough fluid intelligence to be able to function at a fairly high level. Just how high a level is very much a function of starting, just as was just pointed out, in early childhood. There are dramatic differences between the social classes and between ethnicities in the kinds of literary and verbal activities that go on. In a working class family, most of what is said to a child is in the order of an instruction, do that, don't do that, a correction, or so on. And as you work your way up the socioeconomic ladder, conversations more and more resemble a tennis game. It's serve and return. I mean, the parent says something, the kid says something back, kid asks something, the parent answers something and asks the kid another question. It's a qualitatively different kind of thing. And as we've just been told, there's lots of evidence that that's just crucial to lay the groundwork for intelligence. Beyond that, it's a question of learning particular skills. Those skills, the more you read, the more literature you're familiar with, the larger the range of concepts that you have. There are other ways of hanging around with smart people is a very good idea, because there is some evidence that you tend to gravitate toward the average of the set of people that you spend the most time with. And part of that is verbal instruction, basically, from other people.
Very quickly, Richard, because we have to go to a break here, but, you know, another thing that strikes me, and I know it's been part of your research anyway, is that we increasingly also live in a global society. We're not just hanging around with the other people in New York City or Cincinnati or San Diego. We're hanging around with all the people in the world, and we're doing business with them. We're exchanging knowledge with them. And I'm guessing that the way intelligence is evaluated and cultivated differs from society to society. I know you have some thoughts anyway about the difference between the way that's done in Asia as opposed to, say, the U.S.
Well, there are differences. I don't think that there are important differences with the kinds of intellectual skills that I study across rich societies. I mean, it's really the same set of skills. There are subcultures within each society which emphasize different things to different degrees, and there are some subcultural groups which actually have overall average lower IQ. We were just talking about one of those, the black-white difference, which is diminishing constantly. If you look at societies which are pre-literate, pre-industrial, it's shocking to us the degree to which they lack intellectual skills that we tend to think of, and well, that just comes with the territory. That's part of the hardware. Ability to think abstractly is a relatively new invention. It's basically post-industrial revolution. If you were to, there's a wonderful study done with pre-literate people in the Soviet Union, the old Soviet Union. You talk to a peasant, you say, in the north, all bears are white. I got a letter from a friend recently who told me that he had seen a bear. He lives in the north. What color do you suppose the bear is? And the answer would be, why do you ask me? I mean, ask your friend who saw the bear. There just isn't an ability to apply what to us is just part of the hardware but isn't. That is, if P then Q, P is the case, there now I know that Q is the case. People can use that prior to education. They can use it only for materials that they're extremely familiar with. Same thing is true for hypothetical reasoning. If you were to ask someone in 1750, how do you think you would think about that if you were French? You say, well, that's ridiculous. I'm not French. I couldn't be French. I mean, there's no concept of hypothetical reasoning. And so these are the kinds of things that the Industrial Revolution required. We got them. We're continuing to get them more and more all the time. But the kinds of things that are needed for the information age, we do a spotty job of. And we're getting big subcultural differences in that, I should say. I've been studying what happens 2 years of education at the University of Michigan, and students in the behavioral and social sciences gain a huge amount in the way of these kinds of information age tools, probability, statistics, scientific methodology, to solve not just professional problems, but problems in their everyday life. They understand them quite differently.
Richard Nisbett, I'm going to just break in here because we've got to hit a break. Nate Silver is texting me again. So Richard Nisbett, professor of social psychology, co-director of the Culture and Cognition Program at the University of Michigan at Ann Arbor, author of Mindware, Tools for Smart Thinking. Thank you so much for joining us today. We'll be back with more of Annie, and we're going to add another guest as we begin to talk about artificial intelligence.
Yes, you think you know it all.
Don't go away. In the final segment, Colin and the guests will tackle the question of whether true intelligence can exist outside the sphere of human consciousness, in an actuary, for example. Today's show was produced by Josh Nalea and me, Kyone Wolf. Greg Hill appeared in the intro and tweets for us at WNPR Colin. Our interns are Leah Myers and Esther Shitu. The part of Bill Curry was played by Jim Carrey. For show pages, articles, and the IQ scores of the Here and Now staff, go to our website, wnpr.org/Colin. And visit our brand new Colin McEnroe Show Facebook page. On tomorrow's show, the nose listens to the sound of Paul Simon. And now, back to Colin.
Yes, you can listen to David Green interview Paul Simon in the morning and then listen to us talk in depth about this remarkable new album on the show tomorrow. But right now, we're talking about intelligence. And still with us is Annie Murphy-Paul. Her book is Thinking Outside the Brain, The Power of Our Surroundings to Make Us Smarter. Her blog is The Brilliant Blog. Joining us also is George Dvorsky, a leading bioethicist, futurist, and transhumanist. He's also a science and futures writer for Gizmodo. So, George Dvorsky, we've been talking about intelligence in a lot of different ways, but particularly I think in the ability to figure out how to solve the problem that's in front of you, the problem that you need to solve. So using that or some similar definition, how close is artificial intelligence or machine intelligence getting to what humans are able to do?
Well, we're getting there closer and closer all the time. I mean, we have machines today that already far exceed human capacities in many important ways. I mean, since the 1990s, for example, we've had computers that can defeat the world's greatest chess players. Even more recently, was Google's AlphaGo won the first several games against the grandmaster Lee Sedol in a Go tournament. And for many years, we didn't think that was going to be possible. And of course, we have other tools at our disposal that arguably are imbued with intelligence that can perform many tasks that exceed human capacities. I mean, look at the lowly calculator, for example. It's been around for many, many years, and it can arguably do math hundreds, if not thousands, or even million times better than humans can. But obviously, you're looking at some the more kind of generalized intelligence that is associated with human intelligence, or what artificial intelligence researchers refer to as artificial general intelligence. For example, if we were to put Deep Blue or AlphaGo into a rainstorm, it would have no sense, for example, to pick up an umbrella and cover itself to prevent it from getting wet and being destroyed. That's because it's got a very narrow sense of intelligence. It's been highly specialized to perform a specific task. Now, the ability to create intelligence that has this more broader, flexible, adaptive intelligence, that we are really far off from that. So any kind of discussion about human level or generalized level AI being imminently present, it's overstated. We're still decades away, maybe even a century away from achieving that kind of intelligence.
Right. So, and by the way, George Jaworski is joining us right now by Skype. So you could obviously teach that machine to do that. You could teach that machine to know what it means to be rained upon and what to do, what you wanted it to do, what it should do in the event of rain. You could teach it that. But I guess what you're saying is, can it generalize? Can it have a whole series of experiences that what you would maybe even call qualia, conscious experiences of something, and from that know another thing to do that wasn't anywhere on that original menu?
Well, what we're talking about here are two very distinctive things. There's intelligence and then there's consciousness. And it's very important that we don't conflate those two concepts. Mm-hmm. And in discussions of artificial intelligence and often in intelligence in general, they are conflated and it's very frustrating. Your ability to sense the world around you, for example, looking at the color of red or smelling freshly baked bread or even the visual sense that you have, that's very much part of, as you mentioned, the experience of qualia and consciousness in general. But the actual cognition that's happening, the computation, if you will, that's happening inside the brain is a separate process. Obviously, human consciousness is deeply tied to those cognitive abilities, but they are two mutually exclusive entities. We are extremely far away from having any sense of how to program machines to have consciousness at this point, mostly because we don't have a proper theory of consciousness yet, or what the cognitive scientist David Chalmers refers to as the hard problem of consciousness. We've got some basic ideas, but for the most part, we're not even close to being there. So for the time being, there's no way that our machines will have this level of introspection, these kinds of internal cogitations where it can ruminate philosophically or existentially on its existence and even get a sense as to what it's feeling or what it's experiencing in the world.
Annie Murphy-Paul, really quickly, it seems as though the likely place of quick advancement would be maybe on the other side, what you've already talked about, which is that machines extend the capacity of our brains. I'm going to ask George about this as well, but that would seem to be where the growth might come, is using a machine to make the brain even better.
Yes, and to compensate for our weaknesses, which are not the same as the weaknesses of a computer. I think, our investigations into AI, our research on AI has illuminated a lot about human intelligence. What seems hard to us is easy for a computer. And what seems easy to us, like learning a language, without even being consciously taught, or navigating around a rough landscape, or sensing what another person is feeling and thinking. Those things are really, really hard for computers to do. And as George said, computers are not likely to be able to do that anytime soon.
George, we're running out of time, but if you can do it in 30 or 40 seconds, I'm assuming there'll be kind of a discomfort with the brain equivalent of the robotic arm, basically, putting mechanics into the brain in order to make it better and have the computing power of a machine is an area of discomfort.
It is, but we will likely get there. I mean, there already is conversations about what's called intelligence augmentation, and that can happen through neuropharmaceuticals, for example, but it could also happen through cybernetics. And if that's the case, I mean, we should see substantial jumps in human intelligence, and that obviously that's a wide array of capacities, including memory and, of course, those IQ smarts and mathematical abilities. I think the larger question is just how well-adjusted, how adaptable will these people be with extremely high intelligences? It may actually prove to be an untenable proposition, and that we may actually see some real personality disorders and real problems living in the world with that kind of intelligence.
And on that note, we've got to stop. Thank you, George Jaworski. Thank you, Annie Murphy-Paul. Thanks, Josh Nalea, for producing. We'll be back tomorrow with the news.
Stupid Rubik's Cube. Can't figure it out. Ugh, that's it. I figured it out.